Thank you for letting me speak at this thing. It's awesome to be here. And thanks, John, for setting me up. So I'm going to repeat some of the things John said because it's very closely related, the thing I'm going to talk about and the thing he talked about. And this is work done with Bryce Beverlin and Tay Nekhas. I just want to remind you of that. So if you look at this sort of diagram of basal ganglia connections, very simplified diagram of basal ganglia connections, these are the connections we usually think about when we're thinking about deep brain stimulation. So the cortical neurons, whose axons go by the subthalamic nucleus, but some of them also make synapses in the subthalamic nucleus, so those axons are in the subthalamic nucleus. And then those cells also give collaterals into the striatum, which then inhibit the GTE and GTI. And the subthalamic nucleus cells, of course, have axons that go to both GTE and GTI. And then the GTE neurons have an inhibition in GTI, but they also send an axon into GP, into STN. So if we imagine that we're stimulating the STN, and what Cameron has taught us is that we should be asking what axons are there in the STN, not necessarily what cell bodies are there, but what axons are there, because the axons are what preferentially get stimulated, and the axons are cortical axons, STN axons, GPE axons. And so if we stimulate here, we can expect to get at least a connection through the striatum and maybe other things that the cortical neurons do. We should get an excitatory monosynaptic response in GPI. This is the neuron we're interested in because it's the output of the basal ganglia. We should get a monosynaptic inhibition in GPI because of this axon reflex. The action potential goes up backwards up the axon, then down this branch and inhibits in GPI. And we should get a disynaptic inhibition, the activation of GPE and then into GPI. And I would sort of point out to you that with the exception of the cortical axon, if we stimulate in GPE, we get basically the exact same stimulus that we gave in STN. The same axons are there. And if we stimulate in GPI, we get the same set of axons. So if axons are what's important, then it shouldn't matter too much which of these three places we're stimulating. The cortex is the exception. The cortical axon should be more accessible in STN than anywhere else. So if cortical axons are important, STN should be preferred place to stimulate. So now I'm just going to remind you of some stuff John said, but I couldn't be positive he would say it, but he did. But I'm going to say it anyway. So there have been sort of three primary explanations that have been offered for DBS, if I may simplify them into three. One of them is this ancient venerable diagram, which everybody shows all the time, which says that the width of these arrows in this diagram are supposed to be firing rates of the neurons. So this is a steady state rate model. And so it basically says that if we were to remove the subthalamic nucleus, we would remove some excitation here, and that what's wrong in Parkinson's disease is the GPI cells are going too fast. Because the GPI cells are going too fast, according to this model, the thalamic cells can't work. They're basically turned off. And so anything that requires the thalamus to go, which presumably includes movement, gets stopped. That was the old way of viewing it. And DBS threw a monkey wrench into that, because if you stimulate STN, that should make the cells go faster. You're stimulating faster than they normally fire. That should make the GP cells go faster than normal. That should inhibit the thalamus more and should be bad. Yet, STN stimulation works. And so the first thought was, well, maybe STN stimulation doesn't make the cells go faster, right? They might paradoxically make everything shut down. So that had to be checked. And it was checked, and it wasn't so. It doesn't make them shut down. The STN axons are firing, and the GPI cells are going faster. Maybe not a lot faster, not as fast as the stimulus, but faster than they normally would go. And so that shook up that rate idea to the point that I think the rate idea is faltering, falling at this point. And the second idea, which was sort of stimulated by work on MPTP poisoned monkeys, of which this is an example, and John already showed it. But in that work, the GP neurons in normal monkeys, both GPE and GPI, were recorded in pairs and in groups of neurons larger than pairs. And the surprising finding was that even though those cells share a lot of common inputs, their firing was almost completely uncorrelated. Their cross-correlations were flat. And so it's a little bit of a mystery. Why in the world would cells that get basically the same input not fire in any kind of correlated way with each other? And it's still a mystery we can't quite explain. But the interesting side finding was that in the Parkinsonian monkey after MPTP, that independence of the cells went away. And the cells became synchronous, and they became bursty. And so here you can see what happens to the autocorrelograms of the cells. You can see that individually they're bursting. The cells are, their probability of firing is modulated in a periodic way. That's the right way to say it, because sometimes they're bursting and sometimes they're not. But the cells are oscillatory, and the oscillatory frequency is around 5 to 8 hertz. And then this, if you look at pairs and look at their cross-correlations, you can see the cross-correlograms are rhythmic at about twice that frequency. That's kind of interesting that it's about twice that frequency. And that frequency is around 12 to 14, which is what we just saw in John is what the monkey's beta rhythm looks like. It's a little slower than a human's maybe. And so the cells are firing at about half beta, and then the network is sort of the correlation among the cells is going at about full beta. And then the other thing about those cells is that they're not just oscillatory, but they're oscillatory in a synchronous way. And so there are big peaks in these cross correlations. So as John pointed out, that you can ask the question, is the problem in the firing pattern of the individual cells, or is the problem in the correlation among the individual cells? And each of those changes can do something that could harm the activity of the thalamus, could mess up the activity in the thalamus in some way. And so we could ask, I wonder which it is. Is it that the cells are bursty, or is it that the cells are bursty in a synchronous way, or both, or some other thing? So one clue about that comes from this very interesting paper. This is a paper by this group, who are a famous group of basal ganglia clinicians and scientists who were studying Parkinsonian patients at the time that they were changing their batteries. And so at the time that you're getting your battery changed, they disconnect your electrodes from the little periodic oscillator that's making the stimulus. And so they asked, I guess, or they must have, asked the patients, is it okay if we connect you up to this other stimulator sitting on the table and try some things? And the patients must have agreed, I guess. And so what they asked the patients to do was something very simple, but something neurologists are always asking Parkinson's patients to do. It's this. So do this as fast as you can. And then they were measuring how rhythmic it was and how fast it went. And if, without any stimulation at all, the patients were not very rhythmic and not very fast. And you can see these little up and down indicate the actual pressing of whatever measure it was that they were using. So the tapping of the fingers is very irregular and not very high frequency. And then they turned on DBS stimulus at 130 hertz, and now the tapping gets very regular and fast. And then they did the new thing. And the new thing was just to add jitter. It's still 130 hertz, but instead of being locked on exactly 130 hertz, it shook just a little bit, and there was a little error on when each pulse came in. And then they just added more jitter, and asked what happened. And this shows what happened. You can look at any of these, they're all the same, but this one is duration. And you can see when there was no jitter, there's this big improvement. Down is good. This is DBS off. And then they just added 10%. That is a CV of 0.1, which is not very much jitter, then the effectiveness of the DBS went bad. And at 30%, it was like no DBS at all. So that's remarkable, because it it says that the thing it is that's working about DBS, it requires the periodicity of the stimulus. Yeah. I don't think that 143 made it go completely away, but I don't think that was in the paper. But I don't think that that little 10%. Then of course the mean isn't changing here. Yeah, there are lots of very cool things that you could do if you could connect the patients up to any gadget you wanted. I could think of a lot of them that I'd like to see. So, but the thing that we can gain from this is that in order to be effective, DBS has to be periodic. Really periodic. And so what is it about a periodic stimulus that could make it something special? And so it is important to realize that the cells in the basal ganglia, the STM cells, the GPE cells, the GPI cells, are all oscillators. They will all fire autonomously when they're disconnected from their input. They all have natural frequencies at which they go. And the frequency at which they fire in vivo, under normal circumstances, is very close to the frequency at which they will fire in the absence of synaptic input. The difference is how irregular are they, not so much what rate they're going. So here's an example from, this is from the SNR. In rodents, the SNR is the GPI. There is a kind of other nucleus that's sort of like the GPI, but it's very small, and basically the GPI I and the SNR are twins separated at birth. And you can switch back and forth between them pretty much at will, and they will be the same thing. So this is looking at SNR in a rat, and this is work by Atherton and Bevan. And here is a recording from a cell in a slice, and you can see that it's firing along at the rate that these cells go, and this is actually mice, I think. In mice, which is quite a bit slower than the rate they go in monkeys, which is probably a little bit slower than the rate they go in humans. But this is the firing rate of the cell, and they block all synaptic input that they can, all the fast synaptic input they know how to block, using these various blockers for GABA and glutamate receptors, and doesn't do a thing. It doesn't change the rate, and it doesn't change the coefficient of variation. So that means that these cells would fire like that in the absence of synaptic input. And in monkeys, that kind of experiment can be done in vivo and has been done by Kita and his lab. They're recording from a GP neuron, and then they infuse blockers of synaptic transmission into the GP. And when they block both glutamate and GABA transmission, the cells are still firing at the same rate they did before, but now they've become perfectly periodic, whereas before, they were all irregular. So probably the way to think about these cells is as perturbed oscillators. They're oscillators that are getting perturbed at a very high rate, and that's what causes them to become irregular. So what do we know about periodically driving an oscillator? And there's actually a lot known about that. Many of you may know more about it than many of you certainly know more about it than I do. But one of the most famous things about periodically driven oscillators is that they can exhibit a sort of sequence of different kinds of patterns. So at very low input, low strength inputs, they may become sort of slightly entrained, and then at a little bit higher, they may become synchronous. And if they are stimulated at the right frequency and the right intensity, they can become chaotic. And that is certainly true of neurons as well as model oscillators. And here's, it's been studied in squid axon, for example, and in the model of the squid axon, which is really an extraordinary good model for squid axon. And this is a little model of a globus pallidus, or substantia nigra, pars reticulata cell from a mouse. And so here is, in this model, there are two identical cells, and they were started at slightly different phases, the red one and the blue one, and they will maintain that phase because they're identical. So they keep their phase difference. And if we start to stimulate at just the right rate, which in this case was 114 hertz, then the two cells respond to the stimulus differently. Because of the tiny difference in phase, each one of them gets the stimulus at a different time during its interspike interval. And the cell's response is interspike interval time sensitive. And so each cell responds in a different way from the other. And when the next stimulus comes, they have an even bigger phase difference. And that gets expanded. And so you can see the phase difference between the cells, which was constant. You turn on the stimulation, and it crazily alters. You turn the stimulation off, and they go, they stick at whatever phase they were at. Now, this is a classically studied form of chaotic desynchronization in these cells. It's very hard to understand studying the Hodgkin-Huxley equation or this model, but it can be easier studied using a simple reduction of these kinds of models using the phase resetting curve. So here we imagine our cell. This is just some sort of notation, but this is the cell firing anyway, and it would fire this red spike, and then it would fire the black spike. And then we have perturbed it at some time in the interspike interval, and it fires the next spike a little bit earlier because of that perturbation. And so we can plot the size of the perturbation, the size of the change in the time of the next spike as a function of the time of our perturbation arriving. And that's the phase resetting curve. And so here is the phase. Now I've just normalized everything for the natural period of the cell. And so here is the phase of the cell, and we can give a stimulus at any time along there. And this is the change in phase that our stimulus gave us. And we get a curve that looks something like this. This is actually for that model of the substantia nigra pars reticulata cell. And as the stimulus goes up and down, this curve scales and changes shape just slightly. One sort of remarkable thing about it is that if the stimulus is big enough, it will fire a spike right now. And so, for example, if we're at 0.8 and we give this stimulus, it will not be able to fire a spike any earlier than 0.2, 0.8, 0.2 or 1. That's it. It can't go any earlier than that. And so the phase resetting curve gets distorted by this reset line. So as we turn the stimulus down, we don't have any problem with this. But as we turn the stimulus up, we're going to run into it. Now, this phase resetting curve can be turned into a one-dimensional map for stimulation if the stimulation is periodic. So for periodic stimulation, we can replace this with this. And the way that's done is just to take the identity line. This is now the phase on cycle I and the phase on cycle I plus 1. And this is the identity line. In the case of no stimulus, that is the line that would describe the map. As the stimulus turns on, we're going to add the phase resetting curve to the map. And if the stimulus frequency is different from the cell's frequency, we're going to have to scale the whole map up and down. So the stimulus is going faster than the cell in this case, so we have to push the whole thing down below the identity line. We get a crossing here, and that crossing is a stable point, and the cell will end up being entrained to the stimulus at that phase. By the way, if we ran into this causal limit, resetting line, in the course of this, that'll give us a flat place in our map. Flat places in the map are bad. I'll tell you why. So you can get the entire range of behavior of a forced oscillator with this map just by changing the stimulus frequency and by changing the stimulus intensity. The stimulus intensity causes this thing to be curved as opposed to straight, like this, and the stimulus frequency causes it to be shifted as opposed to going to zero. And so at a high enough frequency, we can still have an intersection, and that may be a stable point. And if we end up on the unstable side of it, we'll have to walk away and come back in from the other side. But eventually, we'll end up at this point. But if the stimulus frequency is too high, then there won't be any stable point. This thing will slip below, and there's no stable fixed point. If there's not much modulation, if this thing isn't very curvy, then we just get independent walking through phase of the cell relative to the stimulus. But as it starts to get curvy, then some places, the difference between two cells that land at slightly different places on this line will get expanded because the slope here is greater than 1. And so that can pull those phases of the cells apart. And that's what causes the expansion that leads to the decorrelation of the cells. And at this place where the curve is non-monotonic, they can be folded over each other. So two trajectories that enter heat like this can leave switched. And so this curvature and this non-monotonic place is the formula for chaos. And the key to getting it to be chaotic is to have these expansion regions be as large as possible. The limit to how large they can be is that resetting line. If you make them too big, they won't go run into it. For inhibition, the phase resetting curve is the same, except it goes in the opposite direction, and there's no phase resetting line to worry about. You make the stimulus as big as you want. So if now we look at what's happening to the phase difference between the red and the blue lines, we can see in this case, it exponentially approaches zero as the two cells both end up at the same phase relationship to the stimulus. And here, if we start the two cells very close to each other, their phase difference will blow up over time. And the tendency to gradually converge to zero or to blow up is defined by the Lyapunov exponent. If it's negative, they'll come together. If it's positive, they'll blow up. And so we can measure that as a measure of how likely we are to get desynchronization from our stimulus. So here, we have plotted this for our neuron for a bunch of different stimulus frequencies and intensities. So one is one times the natural frequency of the cell, and two is two times the natural frequency of the cell. And this is just changing our stimulus from something very small to something quite large that runs into that resetting line. And so you can see that when the stimulus is very small, the Lyapunov exponent is very close to zero, which means there's no change in the relative phase of the cells. They're not being synchronized or desynchronized. As we turn up the stimulus, we start to get these frequencies at which the cells tend to synchronize. And of course, near one, if we're stimulating at the same frequency as the cell, then we get this beautiful area of synchronization, and this is blue and white are synchronizing. But an interesting thing happens when we start to get above 1.5 times the cell's natural frequency, and the stimulating intensity is in the right place. And that is, we get this positive Lyapunov exponent that indicates that cells in a group of identical cells like that would get blown apart in their synchrony. Inhibition is much more likely to produce a chaotic result because of the fact that you can just keep turning the stimulus up and keep turning it up, and you don't run into any resetting line, and that just gets curvier and curvier. Okay, well, this is a pretty abstract kind of model of this, of any neuron, and one of the first things that I would want to do is to add noise. Because if you looked at this, you can see there are all kinds of tiny little places. I don't know, well, you can see it, and if you could zoom in better, you'd see more and more of them. Little places where synchrony sits right next to asynchrony in a beautiful but somewhat crazy-looking pattern. And so one of the questions is, you know, is that stuff really real? And all of this is predicated on the fact that the cell is an absolutely perfect oscillator whose period never changes. And our real cells, we measure their standard deviation of their inner spike interval histogram all the time. And even though they're pretty good, like their CV is usually less than 0.1, it's often 0.02 or 0.03, but still it's a significant deviation from being a perfect oscillator. And so we need a way to represent the variance of the phase resetting curve. It's not just the variance of the cell's inner spike interval that matters, it's what that does to the phase resetting curve. And so the solution to that was recently obtained by Bard, Ehrmantraut, and Tay, and Weiss, Beverlin, and Todd Troyer, and it was published this year. And so I want to show you their result. It's their result, not mine, but I want to show it to you anyway. This is a little simulation that I did of their results. So this is a Monte Carlo simulation of a bunch of different trials on the same neuron. And the neuron has a phase resetting curve, and it's constantly being perturbed by noise. And it's being perturbed at every time point by noise. So each of those little noise impulses at every time point is a perturbation that acts through the phase resetting curve to change the latent phase of the cell. And on average, those things don't accumulate. So here's before the stimulus, and you can see that the average phase is just progressing very nicely. We give the stimulus and we get a jump in phase, and then the average phase progresses nicely, and we can see the change in phase here. But the variance of the phase doesn't do that. So here is our, this is the Monte Carlo simulation. This is the distribution of latent phases as a function of time. You can see it just gradually gets spread out. This is, when it crosses there, it fires. So each trajectory that crosses there will fire an action potential. And this distribution that you see at the end is the interspike interval distribution. And so only turned around backwards. Should flip it, left, right, flip it in your mind. And that would be the interspike interval distribution. So you can see that the stimulus is perturbing this cell at some phase out here. And at that point, the cell has this distribution of latent phases. And each trajectory is getting a stimulus at a slightly different phase. And so that causes the error in the phase resetting curve. And this is the standard deviation of latent phase, and this is what that would look like if we plotted the standard deviation of the phase resetting curve as a function of time in this Monte Carlo simulation. And what Bard et al. Did was to come up with an approximation for low noise that allows us just to have a function that tells us what that deviation of the phase resetting curve will be. And so here is a typical phase resetting curve and obtained in this Monte Carlo simulation. And this red line is the phase resetting curve that was used in the simulation to create that. And then this is the variance in the phase resetting curve that you get. And the red line is their approximation. So it's pretty good approximation. It's pretty good approximation as long as the noise doesn't get too big. You can see it is not perfect. Here's a type 2 cell, and you can see there's a little bit of error in it. So we can use that to make a stochastic version of the map. The stochastic version of the map takes a distribution of phases, and the map that's like the one we had before, except now it's got error around it. And every time through the map, the error accumulates. So if we start with a delta function on the first stimulus, then the next time through, we get this probability distribution. And then we'd want to give that probability distribution as input and run through that over and over and over again. And when it quit changing, this thing will reach some kind of steady state. When it does, when we see that stationary distribution, that's the correct map for us. That's the outcome. And it's actually, this is the distribution of spikes after the stimulus. So this thing maps on, this map gives us the peristimulus time histogram during DVS at steady state. And so you can see what it looks like. It's kind of funny. I don't know if it's what you would have expected. But in this case, this is a chaotic one, and so there isn't just one peak. The cell is not entrained to the stimulus. If it was entrained to the stimulus, this would be zero. At some latency, there would be a big peak, and that would be zero everywhere else. But it's actually firing at a variety of different latencies on different trials, on different times through. So this is the probability of a spike at various times after the stimulus. What's that? Makes sense to you. So we can use that map to make a little model of the GPI. And so we made a model of 100 GPI cells, all of them represented by maps like that, individual maps. And then give those cells some common input and a common random input and some unshared random input. And the unshared random input keeps them from becoming completely synchronized by the common input. Because a common random input will completely synchronize a bunch of oscillators that have the same frequency. And so to prevent that from happening, we added independent random inputs. So one is like the noise of the cell, and the other one is the shared synaptic noise of all the cells. And we could adjust those two, very much like something that John showed you with C and 1 minus C. We're adjusting those two so that we get the amount of synchrony we want, which is this sort of very rough correlation of the sound. So that's about 2.6 is where we ended up. We're measuring entropy because now we have 100 cells. And so 2.6 is about where we ended up with no stimulus. And you can see down here, it's mapping to about that shade of gray. And then as we turn up stimulus frequency and intensity, we find this place where the entropy blows up. Everywhere else, the entropy either goes down, like it does along these tongues, or stays unaffected by the stimulus. So this model did something like, well, very much like, what this really simple Lyapunov exponent measurement gave us. It also reproduced the effect of stimulus CV. So if we use an absolutely periodic stimulus, and now we increase the jitter in the stimulus, we saw the entropy drop off in a way that looks a lot like the way it looked in DBS as you increase the jitter in the DBS. So this phenomenon is a desynchronizing phenomenon on the network that is happening in a certain frequency and intensity range and is relies upon the stimulus being periodic. An aperiodic stimulus won't do it. The map that the chaotic region of that map requires that you hit in this perfectly ordered pattern as you're running down it. And so as you come out the next time, you're going to enter according to where you were, and you have to hit that little non-monotonic region in order to get folded. And if it is aperiodic, you're going to be jumping around on the map too much. That's the best explanation I have for it. I can see it happening watching the map. I can see what's happening is that the trajectory down the map doesn't hit in the correct spots anymore. It's jumping back and forth across critical places, and that's what ruins the folding and expansion. Sorry, that's not the kind of answer you were hoping for. So how about a more, where am I at? Okay, how about a more realistic model still? Because remember, that's just assuming excitation and nothing else. But in the real case, we're getting excitation and inhibition. And so it would be great to have everything like that, but I thought I would just handle the monosynaptic ones first. So here's the monosynaptic pathways, monosynaptic excitation, monosynaptic inhibition, from the STN to the GPI. And these are the two most prominent and the most rapid inputs. These are the ones that happen fast. And their latencies have been measured, and their time courses of the synaptic conductances have been measured. These are things that we know. So we can put in the latency difference between them. We get excitation first, half a millisecond later the inhibition hits. The excitation has a time, a decay time constant of about 2.5 milliseconds. The inhibition of about 6 milliseconds. And so we can make the net conductance that we expect to see from those, or the net current that we expect to see from them. And then we can put that through the phase resetting curve, the stochastic version of it, to try to get a peristimulus time histogram. And this is the peristimulus time histogram. And then I adjusted the excitation and inhibition relative to each other until I could match a peristimulus time histogram that was in the literature from Keith's lab. And so this peristimulus time histogram is just like, really, well, it's very close to the one that Keith published for GPI cells recording from STN single stimuli, single rarely given stimuli. So this is not during DBS. This is the traditional kind of peristimulus time histogram given with the slow stimulus. And so from that, I could construct, from this actually, believing it because of that, I could construct a bunch of phase resetting curves for different frequencies and stimulus intensities. That's more complicated because these do not scale. We're not obtaining these by convolving the stimulus current with the phase resetting curve, because the stimulus is periodic and big. And so this, the small, the weak coupling assumptions cannot be used. And so basically they have to be made by a recursive effect of this stimulus given all the previous stimuluses. So that's why they're different from each other. Inhibition accumulates because it lasts longer than excitation, and so inhibition is pulling our phase resetting curve down. And inhibition accumulates so much that it becomes almost constant at high frequency and pulls this down and prevents the cell from getting into that reset line. And that allows the cell to have very steep slopes on its map without running into the reset line. And that's a key thing. So I think the inhibition is absolutely fundamental to this phenomenon. Anyway, these are a set of phase resetting curves for different stimulus intensities. And at the same frequency, the frequency is about 1.6 times the natural frequency of the cell. And so we ran through that and using the stochastic map, and this is the Lyapunov exponent map that we get. And so I put in 60 hertz as the natural frequency of the cell, because that's sort of the average for monkeys. I know it's faster for people, but I don't know what the right number is. Anyway, I was calibrating against monkeys the whole time. And so this is 60 to 120 hertz, and you can see that we get synchrony at all these low frequencies and low intensities, and there's a little place over here that's going to keep going as we cross the 120 hertz line where we get this really strong desynchronizing effect. And we can see what we would expect to see in the peristimulus time histogram during DBS. And this is the one that's working. This is the stimulus right there. This one is too low. It's down here. And this one is too high. It's up there. So looking at the peristimulus time histogram during DBS and interpreting it is a fraud. It's a problem. The place that's working, the place that's not working, look a lot alike. In no case is there entrainment until the stimulus gets really humongous, like this, and then we're really seeing something that looks like entrainment. And by the way, that because of the accumulation of inhibition, this excitatory synapse doesn't speed the cell up as much as you think it would, and in the effective range, it really doesn't speed the cell up. So this is firing rate. It started out at 60. We're going up 114 up that line, and you see that the cell actually slows down. The effective place for stimulus is right in here, where the cell's frequency is almost not affected at all. And of course, up here, the cell's being entrained. And at some point, you finally entrain the cell. You're making it go the same rate as the stimulus. And then it isn't working. So if this is, I think it corresponds to what clinicians say about there's a good place in frequency and you can't go on either side of it. There's a good place in stimulus strength and you have to, either direction can mess you up. And you have to find the place for stimulus strength that's just right. And this matches that pretty well, I think. So the last thing I wanted to do was to try to see this in an experiment. And so I just started this, and it's sort of preliminary, and I sort of don't want it on the permanent record. But let me just show it to you anyway. So here is like two SMR cells recorded at the same time, and I've got a dynamic clamp system set up to give them both a synaptic conductance that's like the synaptic conductance I'm creating in that model. And so it's got excitation and inhibition. Excitation is strong, inhibition is weak. Inhibition lasts a long time and it accumulates. And unfortunately, I don't have the cells synchronized in this, but if I give the stimulus at the right rate and frequency, the cells will dead on lock to each other. And at this point, I have just lowered the intensity a little bit, and the cells are still being very strongly influenced by the stimulus, but they quit locking. So hopefully I can. So can you see that there is no consistent phase relationship between the cells anymore? Even though they're getting the stimulus exactly at the same time. I hope that isn't just a big blur for you. Is it a big blur? Somebody nod and say yes, it's a big blur. Okay, I make it stop for a second. And then I can scrub along it. So if you look at any one spot, you can see the cells are getting the same EPS speed, but they're getting it at different phases because their phasor setting curves, they have the same phasor, it's not the same phasor setting curve, but the stimulus at different phases is going to fight different phase shifts, and so they wander in phase in no particular time. And this is turning the stimulus up just a little bit. Where it isn't exactly entrained in the cell, but you can see it's very close. So in this cell, it's entrained, and it loses loft, fires a spike, it's out of entrainment, and then regains it, loses it, and regains it. In this case, there is no pattern of that if you follow this. In this case, you follow it for a long time, and you see there was no repeating pattern ever in that gaining and losing of loft. And in this cell, there's also a very fixed pattern which has been lost here. And this is cross correlation in those two cases. So this is cross correlation with a slightly stronger stimulus. This is a super powerful stimulus in both cases. The cell fires in a different pattern if you turn the stimulus off. So in no case then it was too deep. And we got a really strong cross correlation. In this case the cross correlation is being greatly reduced here. And this is this is a paired stimulus time histogram. And so this is time sinks that the stimulus for cell A, time sinks the stimulus for cell B, and there's a spike there's a point for each time for every cycle of the stimulus. And you see that in this case, the cells were either in phase with each other or one cell was firing and the other one wasn't. And in this case, we're sort of filling in the entire range of possibilities. There's simply this little blank spot in here, there isn't much in the way of structure to that. So the basic phenomenon, I skipped through this because I know the basic phenomenon here is this desynchronization by high frequency stimulation. This is a kind of a little model where every time it flashes, red is one stimulus. And so, and it's random, and you can see that the random stimulus, the shared random input, will synchronize the cells. But if we start out with the cells completely synchronized, we give them a high frequency, absolutely periodic input, then we can, and the bright flashes are every time you give the stimulus. And these cells have the same phasor setting curve as the CPI cells, and they blow each other away from synchrony when they're being stimulated. And the minute the stimulation were to go back to the slower thing, they would all coalesce back together. Okay, thank you very much.
Any questions?
Let me put this back on. This is the same question as the one everybody's asking, John. So I think what you're asking is, how does the thalamocortical system work? And that is a good question. I'm completely interested in that, and I'd like to know the answer. But remember that we don't know the answer to the question, how does the thalamocortical system work?
So
I think that John's simulations give us some very strong hints. So when the inhibitory input to the thalamus is powerful for a while, it can shut the thalamus down. And basically, the thalamic neurons can't do their job when they're shut completely down. The input from the basal ganglia is a modulatory input. It's not supposed to be a driver to the thalamus. And so the input to the basal ganglia, individual thalamic neurons get inputs from a bunch of different GPI cells. It's not like they get like the way driver inputs to the thalamus work. And those cells are normally firing independently of each other, and there's some kind of moderate amount of inhibition. And then if the inhibition becomes overwhelming, the cells shut down and can't respond, can't fire action potentials. And when that, if that inhibition abruptly quits, they'll fire a burst, which is also probably not part of the regular information processing job of the thalamic neuron. Now, why would the inhibition become so strong? It could become strong because individual cells are firing at very high frequency, making bursts and stepping on them, or it could because a whole lot of cells are making ordinary kinds of firing patterns and stepping on them. Either way, they get stepped on. And I suppose the worst case is cells are bursting synchronously, because then they get stepped on by everybody firing really fast for a while. So I think that's the sort of logic, such as it is. It's not great. I mean, it would be great to know more about what the job of the motor thalamus is, even what the job of the motor cortex is. You know, we pretend we know more about it than we do. And but this is what we've got at this point.
So how does that change when you start to have heterogeneities in the cells that are getting stimulated?
That's a really great question.
Part two would be, I mean, does inhibition help save you, in fact, so that you could actually tolerate more jitter in your, because it, you know, promotes the expansion, so couldn't you actually tolerate more jitter if you had the inhibition as well?
I haven't thought about that, and I haven't tried that, but I will. The first one is about heterogeneity, and this is something I think about a bunch, because in some parts of the basal ganglia, like the globus pallidus, the neurons are rate heterogeneous. They have this very wide range of natural firing rates, and in other places like subthalamic nucleus, they're not very much so. And I kind of think of that as a feature, you know, but I don't know what it means. In the GPI, there's not a ton of rate heterogeneity. I've been doing these experiments in SNR, which I use as a surrogate for GPI, and the cells are really close to each other. Like that pair, well, one was going about 20 hertz and one was going about 18 hertz. And that's really typical. But what I found is when I turn on the stimulus, the cell that is going the slowest get sped up more than the cell that's going the fastest, and they become closer to each other in rate. And I don't know exactly what's causing that, but I think that the stimulus is homogenizing the rate somehow.
I mean, the PRCs of these cells, are those very similar as well?
The PRCs are also very similar to each other, but they're not identical. But there's quite a bit of error in our measurement of the PRC, I'm discovering. And I think that they could be all basically the same, and that the differences I'm seeing could be all error. That's a good way of saying it. You just answered Nancy's question.
Stochastic, something that selected from a finite number of possible maps.
So this is done by altering the map or by altering the stimuli?
The way to think about it, I guess, is instead of having something completely periodic, you have a finite number of inter-kicks.
Yeah.
That you select. And they're not stochastic, but they're finite. And you can select them.
So maybe you could even design a better stimulus than the perfect periodic one, because you would know where you ought to be on the next transit through the map. That sounds like it could be useful. You know, everybody wants to design a better stimulus that works better. And there's, already, I think Leonid was talking about one idea about that earlier today. I'd like to learn more about that. That sounds like something I'd like to know. Dave? You were going to ask that same question?